Good evening, James McCanny here with My Science Hour, July 28th, 2016. First of all, I apologize for last week's sound problem. I had a setting on my microphone, so I was doing the show over open air, basically, to the sound system. So he had all its ambient room noise, etc., studio in the studio, and instead of having the microphone, you know. So anyway, at the very end, I got it fixed. I apologize for that. Hope it doesn't happen again. They're at it again. The CIA has reconstructed my voice again, made a video. I'm not going to say where it is. I don't want to give it any fame. But trying to say that I'm saying Planet X is here, we're all going to die. They're mixing it in with flat earth. Oh my goodness. It's everything in the kitchen sink trying to use my name to give it some credibility, but it has nothing to do with me. No, I'm not saying that there's Planet X. It's just the CIA. And I don't know why it just came out 2 days ago or 3 days ago, maybe. So I don't know what the score is, but they seem to have a need to try and pin something on me lately. Anyway, well, par for the course. That's been going on for a long time, trying to work on breaking my reputation. But life in the big city, like I tell people, swimming with the sharks. You know, if you're going to do this, be in this business, they're going to come after you, especially if you have real information. But here's the interesting part. People, you know, my audience is out there and were telling me about this. So some people went and posted on there that, hey, this is bogus. This is not Jim McCanny. This is not what he's saying. You know, this is an obvious CIA structure that's trying to defame Jim McCanny. Anyway, this is the interesting part. Those posts get taken down, like, immediately. But they're still visible to the person that posted them. And so the person would write and say, yeah, my posting is still up there. And I said, check it out and see, go from somebody else's account, you know, a friend or another computer or another IP address or whatever. And sure enough, to everybody else, that posting that they put up defending me is not there. And to them, it is there. So it's selective, what do you call it? Selective response to knowing who the person who wrote that is, thinks that their posting is still there, but it's not. Anyway, crazy. I talked a couple weeks ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, about doing just science on this hour, not having commercials and sponsors and all of that. And I had actually put up a link for donations on my webpage, and I left it up for a while, and then I took it down. So there's no more donation on my webpage, although, enough of that. So the only real way to support me in this commercial-free radio show is by making purchases through the sales page. Okay, so enough of that. Last, my main science topic tonight, I'm going to be talking about comet orbits, the dynamics of comet orbits. And you might think, well, what does this have to do with me? So what I want to do is give you a little prelude here about the various things. And the kickoff of this topic came from an announcement this week that scientists think that Venus, not Jupiter, but Venus, has something to do with changing Halley's Comet orbit. And, of course, it's like everything they do. It's a flash in the pan. They noticed one little thing that seemed to corroborate their story. So they go on that and, like Tennessee Tuxedo, go off on a tangent. But interestingly enough, people within their own community were saying, hey, don't try and extrapolate this too far, knowing that they're wrong. There's possibly a remote chance that something might fit. And, of course, the planets do affect comet orbits. So if something, a comet comes very close, well, obviously it's going to affect the orbit. But these comets are irregular all the time. In fact, the ancients called comets the lawless ones. They didn't fit the regular rules which they knew of celestial mechanics. And they knew how to calculate ellipses of the sun, of the moon, inferior in conjunctions of like Venus. They had this down to an art. They knew exactly the day, the minute when these were going to happen. So they knew that the comets did not follow the rules. Anyway, I'll be talking about that. Many, many aspects to this. I'll be talking about some particular comets, Schumacher-Levy 9, and when it hit Jupiter, all of that. Talking about how my plasma discharge comet model explains this. And I'll be talking about the many type of comet tails, the various types of light that come out, the redshifts in comets, the nucleus of comets, and relating this to ancient events. But first, a couple just quick topics here. Become food and water independent. That's very important, and that'll be on my webpage. So that's the extent of commercials tonight. Become food and water independent. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. I saw a brilliant show this week. It was on television. I watch a lot of international TV. And it was families and children and music and singing. And some of the singing wasn't the best, I'll have to admit. But it was a community that said, hey, this is the old-fashioned type of community. And I believe it was in Spain. I think this event took place in Spain. And the kids sang, and there were probably a dozen different types of musical instruments, mainly guitars and utes and mandolins and those types of instruments. And somewhat simple music, but pretty. But what it struck me is, you know, here in the United States, what do we talk about when we talk about schools? You know, Common Core and shootings and insanity. You know, just total insanity, just history that doesn't have anything to do with reality. And I watched this show with these kids and the family singing and the people watching. And it was really wonderful. So that's what we got to get back to. Common values, not the insanity that's going on in public schools. I wouldn't have a kid in a public school. No way in the world. I mean, I would want my kids to go to, if I had kids, I mean, I would want them to go to a school for socializing and, you know, all of those type of things. But schools today are just nuts. So, yeah, get your kids out of there. Plus, they don't learn anything. They spend 12 years being programmed out of existence. Also, just a quick comment on the Tour de France. I watched quite a bit of it. But what a wonderful event. And to see France, and that's a big part of the Tour de France, is to see the route and the little towns and the people standing there waving. Once again, a wonderful event. The Solar Impulse 2 airplane, powered strictly by 800 pounds of lithium-ion batteries. I don't know if it finally got to Abu Dhabi. I suspect it did by the time I'm doing this show. Unfortunately, I can't track all of these things. But it was a 48-hour flight. And the tracking around the world, this is the last leg of its flight around the world. So completing a complete around-the-world flight totally on solar cells and batteries. So the path that they went was from Abu Dhabi to Oman to India to Myanmar to China to Japan to Hawaii to California to New York and then to... I'm not sure if where they landed in my notes end here, so I'm not sure where they landed, whether it was in England or France or whatever, and then on to Egypt and then back to Abu Dhabi, completing the complete round the world mission. $170 million mission control center, and this plane flies 90 miles an hour, so they had to time it, of course, with weather situations. And some of the, well, of course, the ocean crossings were very critical. So they had to have very good weather, of course, not super good weather, but they did hit some, you know, not so good weather. But this plane made it. It's bigger than a 747 airliner in size, but it weighs like the same as a minivan. It's very light. Anyway, congratulations on the staff. Picard, who is the main man in this deal. This is, once again, wonderful to see. It just gives you a sense of where we should be as human beings. And probably this should have been done 100 years ago, literally, if we wouldn't have had World War I and II and all the other wars and the Korean War and the Vietnam War. Look at the wasted humanity and effort in the wars, you know, and now all the modern wars, absolute insanity all caused by the same group of just criminal, evil people. But the interesting part about the flight around the world with solar power is there are now other technologies that can come into play. And I'm expecting a non-stop electric flight around the world. And I'm not going to talk about it on the air because I happen to have a little bit of a position in making that happen. But anyway, the next possibility is a round-the-world non-stop electric flight. Now, how do you do that? Well, and using naturally occurring electricity. Just a quick note on Pokemon Go. This is the Pied Piper. This is, I've mentioned before, it's a totally CIA-controlled initiative. And now get this. They are talking about Pokemon hate speech. If you say anything bad about Pokemon, you're a Pokemon hater. Hate speech. If you say anything bad, isn't this bizarre? That you can't say anything bad about a telephone or a tablet game. Mainly people are doing this on their phone. And if you do, you're a hater. You're a hater. Oh, gee. This is total CIA. But this is controlling people. Pokemon Go is an experiment. It's a social experiment. And, if you say anything bad, you're a Pokemon hater. Wow. This past week, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, sent out a recommendation, which is going to turn into regulation. And this was spurred by Obama, who asked the EPA to assess jet fuel pollution relative to so-called greenhouse gases, which is a total farce. The whole issue with burning jet fuel, and I've talked about this many times on my show, it's a technological issue, with the very same airframes that we have in commercial aircraft today, starting back with the 727s, all the way up. The 727 was had the two engine jets in the rear. Now they put them up on the wings. Clearly there were some little issues. You had a lot of turbulence behind the wings and everything, putting the engines in the back. But now the fleets of airliners have the jet engines, typically two, no matter how big they are. The 777s have two just giant Rolls-Royce jet engines, one on each wing. But the point is, now they're talking about the chemical pollution relative to greenhouse gases of jet traffic. And they give some statistics, etc. But you got to be kidding me. The EPA, why wouldn't they talk about chemtrails where the jets are literally spraying poisonous chemicals into the air and they're worried about greenhouse gas effect of normal jet fuel? Oh my goodness. Are these people so corrupt? And then you get the laundry list of PhD scientists out there, you know, parading themselves up and down, pretending like they're important. This came from, by the way, spacedaily.com, a total government mouthpiece, so-called science magazine. And I'll list some other ones here. Space Daily, The Daily Mail, Wired, Geek Wire magazine. All of these, Discover magazine, all of these are total disinformation rags, have nothing to do with science. And unfortunately, here's the bad part, is when they say something, it's total propaganda. And this, they don't really give you science. There's no science in the science reporting at all, if you look at it. So this gives people, especially Americans, the impression that this is science. They give you a headline, which is totally false. They give you some government data, which is totally falsified and misleading, and then bring you down to the final end result, which they give you, and they don't give you enough information. When I look at things, of course, I can read through them, and that's what I try and teach my audience, is how to read through the lines, between the lines. But interestingly enough, in the EPA study, they exclude the military. The military doesn't count. They burn more jet fuel than all the airlines put together, and have no recourse on pollution or anything else. Good grief. And of course, this is all linked to their global climate change agenda. But here's the bottom line. Obama wants to regulate the airline industry. They want to regulate it again. And the airline industry has been deregulated for a very long time. When I was a kid, I grew up with a guy named Steve Rothmeyer, and he became president of Northwest Airlines. And that was the impetus to deregulate the airline industry. He wrote his master's thesis. I think he went to Notre Dame, but he wrote his master's thesis on deregulation of the airline industry, which got him the position of president of Northwest Airlines, at the time hubbed in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But he was spearheaded the deregulation of the airline industry. And, of course, everything has its problems, but deregulation was one of the better things that happened to the airline industry. Now they want to regulate it again, and you know where that's going. Not good. So on to the main science topic, the dynamics of comet orbits. A very interesting topic, something that is important to understand. And when you understand it, you'll be able to relate this, or I'll be able to teach you how to relate it to ancient, the legends, the ancient texts, the Old Testament, etc. So, okay, let's start with some orbits and talk about orbits. The Earth orbits the Sun in a near circular orbit, but really there's no perfect circles in orbits in outer space. They're always off by a little bit, and frankly, they're always changing. But let's imagine in a perfect world, in a hypothetical physics problem, there is a perfectly circular orbit. And let's imagine this is an object all by itself. There's just a star and one object, like a small planet or whatever, orbiting. Now, Earth is a bad example because we have a moon, and that very much alters our orbit from being a circular orbit. So, okay, we're off in the hypothetical land in outer space, have a sun and an object orbiting with a set period, a set amount of time to go around this star in a perfectly circular orbit. Now, what if you could take your finger and retard the motion of that object going around the star? What's going to happen? Well, it would slowly spiral inwards. Okay, this is really an important concept. It would, and you can imagine this. It's going to try and fall in towards the sun. That's what it's doing anyway. It has motion that it's trying to move along a line that's tangential to the orbit of, around the sun, and then it's falling towards the sun, and that's what makes it go around in its orbit. And, of course, the force of gravity is the glue that's making all of this happen. But like I say, imagine you could just put your finger out there and slow it down a little bit. It'll eventually wind its way in like an old-style vinyl record. Now, I talked about something like this a couple weeks ago when I was talking about Saturn's rings. The rings of Saturn do this. They slowly spiral inwards, although the gaps stay in the same place. Now, you would think if the gaps were some kind of structure related to the rings themselves, then those gaps in the rings of Saturn would slowly move inwards, but they don't. And the reason they don't is because they're swept out by moons that are in relatively circular orbits. But as we're going to find out, those moons around Saturn are slowly migrating in towards the planet Saturn by the technique that I'm going to be talking about here. Okay, so now let's talk about elliptical orbits. What's an ellipse? It's just kind of a take a circle and stretch it out, and this elliptical orbit now is moving around the Sun. And there's a lot of peculiarities to this, but I'm not going to go into that here. It's just the fact that comets, let's take a comet like Halley's Comet. It's a long, very elongated, you like take a circle and just stretch it out. But the thing is the Sun does not stay in the center of this ellipse. It moves way down to one side of the ellipse. And so basically the comet goes out and it slows down. So it spends a lot of time and it's the very slowest when it's the farthest distance from the star. And then as it starts turning around and moving back inwards on its elliptical orbit, it's picking up speed and moving faster and faster until it comes into its closest approach to the Sun, whips around, and then goes back out. This is in an ideal world. Now, if you have planets mixed in to this situation, you can have what are called perturbations. And this happens all the time. A perturbation simply means a change in the orbit. That means that if, say, a comet moves by a planet, it's going to change the comet orbit. Okay, but for right now, we're going to deal with strictly elliptical orbits of comets and not have them interfered with by planets, etc. So now let's go back to the very same problem. Say you have a comet, it's in an elliptical orbit around a star. That's all there is, no planets, nothing else, and it's going to keep going and going and going like the ever-ready bunny without stopping. However, there's some things that could happen, and they do happen. But just for a theoretical point of view, say you could take your finger once again, and you could retard the motion of that comet nucleus. And so every time, no matter what direction it's moving in, your finger is always pushing against it, trying to slow it down. What's going to happen to that comet orbit? Well, it's going to slowly fall inwards towards the Sun until it gets to the point where it actually falls into the Sun. But this is called energy damping. And so there's a number of things that are going to happen here when I start getting into a little more detail of the plasma discharge comet model. But there are two things that happen. So this is the comet all by itself without interacting with planets or moons or whatever. There are two things that happen. Remember, the plasma discharge comet model says that the material in the tail of the comet is being drawn into the nucleus. And if that nucleus is large enough to hold the matter that's coming in, these are under electrical forces being drawn into the comet nucleus. And really, to get the full story on this, you have to read my books and understand the plasma discharge comet model and how the electrical nature of these work. It's not just magical. They're not just out there charged magically. No, there's an entire process where the solar wind and the creates a capacitor. The comets discharge that capacitor. And I talked about this on shows in previous weeks, that the electrons are the primary charge carriers, and therefore, as they stream out and encounter the comet nucleus in the discharge, because of the pressure built up around the nucleus of this flow of electrons, it charges the nucleus of the comet up to a negative charge. And this then draws in positively charged ions from the environment, whether they're sulfur or water or hydrogen or sulfur dioxide or whatever chemicals are out there, nitrogen, ammonia, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, all kinds of chemicals. But typically they bring in the atomic species and they combine in the electric field to create these chemicals, not all the way up to nucleotides of DNA have been found in tails of comets. So these are building as this raw material is falling in towards the comet nucleus. But the other thing that happens is as this material builds up on the comet nucleus, that's like your finger. it's doing the same thing. Now, when I was at Cornell, I scoured the libraries for all kinds of material, and there was a lot of wonderful old material. One of them was a book by TJJC, and I referenced this in my three-part comet paper. It's in the appendix of my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes. You can read all about it there. But the TJJC book was in a two-volume set, immense volumes, these giant old books. But anyway, there were two things that happened, and they were looking at this problem from a purely mathematical celestial mechanics viewpoint. And they thought if there was material in the solar system that would drag on the planets, they said, what would the effect of this be in celestial mechanics, the motion of the planets? And so they came up with two things that would happen. One was energy reduction, and that's what we were doing when we put our finger out there. We were reducing the energy, reducing the velocity. When you reduce the velocity of something, you reduce its energy. So you're reducing the energy by the drag that would be put on a planet or a moon or an object, whatever, in the solar system as it moved around through this, what they called the nebular resisting media. They had a name for it. The only problem is there is no nebular resisting medium. And when it was discovered that there wasn't any, then that idea fell out of favor in astronomy. Well, I picked it up because in the plasma discharge comet model, the nucleus is drawing in vast amounts of material, and it acts exactly the same way, even though this comet is moving through space that's relatively vacuum empty. And so anyway, I was able to, because I understood the plasma discharge comet model, I had developed my theoretical work, I realized that now I could reapply TJJC's, and his co-author was named Newton, actually a descendant of Isaac Newton, and I could apply their results to the plasma discharge comet model. So there were two effects of having what they called the resistance medium dragging on a celestial body. Although what they were looking for was generally a kind of like a gas that permeated all of outer space, and there isn't such a thing. There is a little bit, but not enough to slow a planet down to the extent that they thought it could. So anyway, what are the two things? Eccentricity damping, I'll talk about that in a minute, and energy reduction. So what we were talking about, when you put your finger and slow down the comet nucleus or the object moving around a star, what you're doing is reducing the energy of the object. And so what does that do? It causes it to spiral inwards. The other thing is actually more important. It's called eccentricity damping. Now, what is eccentricity? Eccentric people are people that are real high-strung. Well, that's kind of the same in astronomy. Let's go back to that circular orbit, and I'll just tell you this. I won't give you the formulas or anything else. You can look these up if you're a little bit adept at mathematics or whatever. But a circle is a conic section of eccentricity zero. Just remember that. And as the eccentricity grows between zero and one, as the eccentricity value grows, then the circle becomes an ellipse. And the higher the eccentricity value, the longer, the more elongated the ellipse. Very simple. Okay, so what is eccentricity damping? That means that the orbit, if you have eccentricity damping, that means you're starting with some eccentricity. So a comet's orbit, which is typically an ellipse, we're talking about orbits that are in the solar system, not the parabolic or hyperbolic type that come in once and leave and don't ever come back. We're talking about objects in the solar system trapped by the sun and another planet. You need two objects to gravitationally trap an object into the solar system and capture it. But okay, now that it's captured, it's in the solar system, the object's in its elliptical orbit, and it's undergoing the resistance of the tail drag of the plasma discharge comet model. In other words, the comet nucleus is drawing in this material. the material is being drawn into the comet nucleus, and by Newton's second law, equal and opposite reactions create equal and opposite forces. So the nucleus is being drawn back towards the tail. You understand this? What's it doing? It's doing the same thing that your finger did, but the celestial mechanics is very subtle, and TJJC and his partner Newton did an excellent job of understanding what would happen if there were a resisting medium. And what they didn't realize, of course, back in the early 1900s when they did their work and published their book, which was called the title referred to the secular action of the resisting medium on celestial mechanics, and that's what their book was about. But of course, there wasn't a resisting medium. But what they didn't realize, they did not realize that the idea of the plasma discharge comet model and that the resisting medium actually came drawn into the nucleus of the comet by electrical forces. And that's what I came up with when I was at Cornell in 1979, studying this in the stacks of the Cornell Space Science Library. In fact, that book, I believe, was in the general stacks, like a lot of the science books, but of the science library. But at any rate, and of course, that's all changed now. Cornell has a new library structure. But, okay, so let's go back to this. So what's going to happen to that orbit of a comet that's an elliptical orbit, a very elongated circle with the sun off in one kind of edge or corner? It's not a corner, but in one closed region off on the side of that ellipse. What's going to happen to that elliptical orbit when we apply the plasma discharge comet model with the tail being dragged into the comet nucleus and the comet nucleus being pulled back towards the tail? Two things: energy reduction, so the elliptical orbit is going to spiral inward very slowly. The second thing, and more important thing, is eccentricity dampening, and that is where the ellipse slowly becomes a circle. This is what standard science failed to understand when they bombed the Velikovsky verbally out of existence in their own ignorance. Now, this is one of the strangest tales in the history of science, probably more strange than Galileo, probably stranger than Copernicus. Here, Velikovsky was studying calendars, not studying astronomy, not studying the planets. He was looking for a timeline, an event that was worldwide in scope that would allow him to set the calendar zero date and then go forward and backwards in time. And he was looking for some kind of event, maybe, you know, something that happened all over the world, and to put a timeline on it so that they could then take the Egyptians and the Chinese and the Tibetans and the Japanese and the South Americans and the Incas and the Mayas and everybody and give them a zero timeline if we could find out when they talked about such an event. What he discovered was the Venus event. So this was during the time of Moses. This was the Moses event. This was the Quetzalcoatl event to the Mayans. This was the Phoenix event of the South American Native Americans that lived in the American Southwest. And all over the world, this was the Phoenix. This was the on and on. I'm not going to name them all, but there's literally hundreds of references of this in history, and they're all referring to this cometary event. Okay, so once again, Velikovsky was not a scientist. He didn't know about science, but scientists, Carl Sagan and the boys, in their complete ignorance, jumped up and buried him because they thought comets were dirty snowballs. What a bunch of buffoons. These guys are still saying this. In fact, I've got a little posting on my webpage. Go and see it. Remember that the picture of the day has a bit of extended lecture from my show. So go to the center column, scroll down a little bit to the picture of the day, and I discuss cometary, some aspects of comets. But comets are not dirty snowballs. When we got to comets, starting with Jacobini-Zinner in the 1980s, and Halley's Comet, etc., they didn't find snow and ice coming off the comet nucleus. That was all fabricated by NASA. Complete fabrication, misinterpretation of data, and trying to see something that wasn't there to try and corroborate their ridiculous dirty snowball comet model. The problem is that now the whole topic that I'm talking about here was I got the idea of talking about this because this past week some scientists actually announced that Halley's Comet, the very famous Halley's Comet, is as much as 6 months off of schedule. Now imagine this in celestial mechanics. What if Earth were 6 months off schedule every year, every time it came around? You know, or 2 months or 1 month. No, we're within nanoseconds, you know, hundreds of milliseconds of exactly where we're supposed to be. The lunar eclipses, the Mayans could predict them 1,000 years in advance in their calendar system. You know, and that's to the minute that you have to predict lunar eclipses. So all of the planets work on this gravitational basis. And then, of course, when Kepler and those guys came along in the Middle Ages and started Newton, these guys started understanding celestial mechanics, and they did this based on orbits of comets. And of course Halley's Comet was one of the primary first examples, proofs of elliptical orbits. And prior to that, they thought comets were something burning up in the atmosphere. That's what Aristotelian philosophy taught since the Greeks, that comets were up in the atmosphere. And Halley and Kepler go, no, these things are way out there. They're out in outer space, moving around amongst the planets. In fact, that's where the dirty snowball comet model originated, was from Kepler. He said, well, it must be something that when it comes closer to the sun, it gets hot and forms its tail. That's where it came from, and the buffoons are still talking about it today. But now we have much better measurements. There's no ice or snow. I announced this a couple weeks ago, and of course, when it happened, the Paris Air Show last year, the European Space Agency, who landed a probe on a comet nucleus, they go, hey, there's no ice, there's no snow, there's nothing coming off the nucleus. That dirty snowball comet model is completely erroneous. And, you know, well, that kind of leaves the McCanny plasma discharge comet model to explain the phenomena, plus the prediction that there are X-rays, all of the other predictions I've made. All 100% true, and the structure, the many, I'll be talking about the many tail structures of comets tonight, all explained by the plasma discharge comet model. But the point is that the return of Halley's Comet is way off. So if this object is going around the sun and there's really nothing out there, and the ice ball, the snowball comet model theorists say, well, there could be some jetting, but that's pretty minimal. It's going to cause a teeny weeny weeny, very minuscule potential change in orbit. They've never been able to see that or verify it or experimentally verify it. It's just, you know, something out of a NASA textbook that they teach to grad students so they can collect money from them and give them a PhD so they pretend that they're smart. But the reality is that with a dirty snowball, there's no mechanism to cause comets to come in way off schedule. And so they go, well, Halley's Comet has had an interaction with Venus, and so maybe that's the cause. And so the name of the article was saying that Venus was the thing affecting Halley's Comet. And right in the article, Donald Yeoman, who's one of the so-called respected scientist from JPL, chimes in and he says, hey boys, don't get too chipper about predicting changes in comet orbits with this Venus thing, knowing full well that it doesn't account for 99% of all of the aberrations in comet orbits that are observed. Something else is definitely going on, and I'm not going to go into that tonight. I have 2 dozen stories, real stories that I could tell you. Well, I'll tell you one. when Hale-Bopp was first discovered, it was on a near collision course with Earth, and that was in 1991. By the time it actually showed up in about 1994 to be discovered by Hale and Bopp, it had already lost time, and by the time it crossed Earth's orbit a number of years later, I believe it was 1996, Christmas Day 1996, it had lost 3 months of time. And Brian Marsden, when it was first discovered that the nucleus of Hale-Bopp was very large, he said, jetting could not possibly affect the orbit of this comet. He said that. And every day the ephemeris for that comet changed. We trapped the ephemeris, that's the orbital dynamics for that day, and it changed constantly. And now the standard story is that, oh, Jupiter did it. Well, no, Jupiter didn't do it, because Jupiter may have had a minimal perturbation on the orbit of Hale-Bopp. But what I'm telling you is that there's hundreds and hundreds of examples where comets' orbits are dramatically changed. In fact, the bigger they are, the more they're affected by the tail drag. And that's something that was I found out experimentally with Hale-Bopp. Because prior to that, we really didn't have an example. And in my book, Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, in the appendix, the three-part comet paper that was published in the early 1980s, I specifically give Venus as an example, talking about the energy reduction and eccentricity dampening. And I do a calculation showing that a large comet like Venus would have been coming through the solar system, the Velikovsky event, would have taken about 600 years, which is about the time that it would have taken the comet Venus after it came by Earth to nestle into its orbit and then out of mind, out of history in the Mayan legends, etc. And remember, this was about estimated about 1500 BC. By 900 BC, Venus had settled into its current orbit that we see today, very close, and it became the planet Venus by energy reduction and eccentricity dampening. Now, do you see how important this is? This explains how a comet, a giant raging comet captured by Jupiter, comes in through the solar system, has an interaction with Mars, removes Mars of its oceans and atmosphere, comes in, has two occasions to damage Earth. The first one is not too bad, and this is according to the Mayan Chronicles. The first event is not too bad, but the second one is 54 years later, and it really takes Earth for a ride. This is the Moses event. 1,000 years earlier, we had the Noah flood, which was a comet where the Earth passed through the tail of a comet. And so that was not such a dramatic gravitational event where there was mountain building, etc. That was more of a flood which radically flooded the Earth, raised the ocean levels by 200 to 400 feet. That was Noah's flood, and then, of course, the world repopulated after that, coming down to Noah. That's what the Old Testament is about. Yet, how many people believe the Noah's flood and the Moses event that as real events? Most of standard science, if you see anything on it at all, they try and, you know, write it off as, a dam broke over in the Mideast and flooded the Mediterranean, and that was the Noah's flood. No, the Noah's flood was 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain that came from outer space as Earth passed through a giant tail of a comet. And by the way, I made a calculation that if Earth would have passed through the tail of Comet Hale-Bopp, we would have spent about 40 days and 40 nights in the tail. Now imagine that in a comet tail with a tremendous influx of water. That was the Noah's flood, no question about it. Okay, so let me get back to the idea that I'm promoting here, talking about telling you how the plasma discharge comet model explains how objects become moons and planets. And so this is what the scientific community certainly did not understand. They certainly don't even have a clue today about this. that, you know, my comet model is correct. Comets are not dirty snowball. They're hot, dry rocks. Why are they hot? Because they're being blasted by an electron beam. You can cut through steel with an electron beam. So, yes, the comet nucleate is not getting hit. It's getting hit with a broad, not a pencil-like electron beam, but it's enough to heat it up and to heat the hydrocarbons up on the nucleus to the point where they're baked on the nucleus. So that's why you see, like, Comet Bild or 2 or some of the comets, Halley's Comet, pitch black hydrocarbons. That's oil. For those of you less scientific, that's like petroleum oil. Yeah, baked tar onto the surface of the comet nucleus. Pure black, blackest thing in the solar system, no ice, no water, no snow, never was, never will be, and certainly nothing coming off the nucleus to create a tail. So, at any rate, now, what with the plasma discharge comet model, not all comets are big. The vast majority of comets are small, and they're not going to become planets. They might become moons, like Mars has two little moons. You know, and once they get into a lunar state around a planet like Mars, then they stop acting like comets, because that's another thing that's explained by my plasma discharge comet model, is once these objects like Venus get into near circular orbits, then the tail drag, the tail itself, is minimized because they're no longer discharging the solar capacitor, because they're moving in circles of equipotential electrically. This is all complicated stuff, but what I'm telling you is what I could present, for example, in a very complicated graduate lecture in astrophysics, or space science, astrophysics technically. But you still have the doofus scientific community out there. Excuse me, I really hate to talk about this, but it's just obnoxious. It's obnoxious that you have to learn about this on a radio show where I talk about it, I pay for my own airtime, and your, you know, $20 billion a year space agency is walking around with their finger, you know, up their nose or whatever, wherever it is. But unbelievable. This is, I mean, it's beyond criminal stupidity. But the people in Tier 1 science know all about me, my work, and they have learned a great deal from me and my pioneering work. I know this because they come out and talk to me. But anyway, okay, so now we understand how planets form. The objects come in, they're captured, they form comets for a period of time, then we have energy reduction and eccentricity damping, which causes them to fall into circular orbits, in which case the electrical discharge reduces to near zero. We still see Venus flare up occasionally. We still see Earth flare up occasionally. But the eccentricity damping causes them to drop into circular orbits where they lose their tail and become planets. This is the capture model of the solar system that I developed based on the plasma discharge comet model. So comet capture in the formation of solar systems, and that's literally the name of my first book on this topic from the late 1980s. So at any rate, and of course that's all steeped in politics of that time era, because when I was doing my work, and I had not even heard of Velikovsky yet. I wasn't up in Cornell trying to prove Velikovsky right. I didn't even hear about Velikovsky until after I was out of Cornell with all my publications and everything else done already. And then I heard about it. I was telling a friend of mine about my work, and he was a publicist, a journalist. And he said, well, you know, it sounds like what you're talking about is this, what this Velikovsky guy was talking about. And I said, well, who's Velikovsky? And he told me, and I said, so I went and I got a hold of the books, and I started reading these, and I'm going, oh, my goodness, Velikovsky's talking, it's personification of my science work. And, of course, the Velikovsky books were from the 1950s. But now I realize why I got the business when I was at Cornell, because Carl Sagan, who was the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy, and the whole astronomy, geology departments, everybody there, in the sciences had just gotten done burying Velikovsky, you know, literally, physically, and emotionally and verbally, and they didn't want to have anything to do with anybody talking about such supposed nonsense. Only problem is those are the guys that had the totally incorrect theory, and they can't handle it. They cannot handle it, so they continue with this bogus theoretical work. But anyway, this is how planets are formed. This is how moons are formed. They're captured. Of the dozens and dozens of moons at Saturn, probably 50% of them are in retrograde orbits, the littler moons of Saturn, and couldn't possibly have formed by some collapsing dust cloud, which that model doesn't even work anyway. But back to the idea of the plasma discharge comet model. And remember, my past weeks, I talked about Jupiter and Saturn being small stars. So they have this capacitor working, and when the objects come in around them, they can circularize around these objects, Jupiter and Saturn, because they're small stars with ongoing fusion. They have capacitors built up around them. And the discharge, I have a picture on my picture of the day. Go take a look at it. In a little discussion about Schumacher Levy 9, which broke into 21 pieces in 1994, and in July of 1994, the 21 pieces came into Jupiter. They were water comets. All of a sudden, they come into the area around Jupiter. They magically become sulfur dioxide comets. Why? Because they're drawing in the material that was in the local region. Around Jupiter, there's a lot of sulfur dioxide. So why would comets all of a sudden be water comets, and as soon as they get near Jupiter, they change from water comets into sulfur dioxide comets, not a trace of water? So how did all that happen? Well, that's because the dirty snowball comet model is bogus. Doesn't work. Doesn't explain anything. And at that time, the Russian scientists were, of course, already well involved in understanding my work. And they said, yeah, McCanny's right. The dirty snowball comet model is not correct. And so, but they were, drowned out by the dominant Western press, which is very typical, of many things that came out of the scientific community in Russia, which, by the way, they do excellent work over there. They're very serious scientists. They're not bequeathed to the political world of the science in the West. So anyway, let me discuss some of these topics. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and look at the pictures of Schumacher Levy 9, Comet Neat, Comet Borley with no water or ice on the nucleus. Go take a look there. It's in the center column. Just scroll down. And by the way, just to repeat, I'm using my picture of the day on the webpage to support and give you some visual for my show. Oh, and by the way, I forgot to mention this, that any purchases over the next week or maybe couple weeks, what the heck, I will give you also for free my book Comets. It's just the term Comets is the name of the ebook, and it's a book I wrote a couple years ago because it was something that was very necessary with my work. I've got my book, Planet X Comets and Earth Changes and Surviving Planet X Passage, and at last landed to test of the Colburn Connection, etc. But what I needed was a book that simply dealt with the comet issue. And so the book called Comets, it's an ebook format. And if you put in an order for anything on the webpage, the sales page, over the next week or two, I'll not only send you the ebook Water for free and the two MP3 lectures about water, but also throw in the Comets ebook. So just a little bonus, and that helps support my show also. So now you can see why the ancients called comets the lawless ones. They, there were enough comets around that with short period orbits that they could make some calculations and some determinations, and they didn't have Nintendos, they didn't have Pokemon, they didn't have TV. They had the night sky, so they studied it and they got good at it. A lot of these cultures were excellent, probably better than we would be if we were left with the equipment that they had. But they could predict lunar eclipses. They knew the counting schemes, the planets, the orbits, the repetition, everything. So they had clocks and calendars. But they knew that the comets didn't follow these patterns. And so in their primitive sort of way, they were pretty intelligent. In fact, isn't it interesting that modern science just came out the other day and said, hey, these comets are not coming back on a regular basis. They're off as much as 6 months sometimes, as is the case of Halley's Comet. But how many types of comet tails are there? Most of us think there's a comet tail, a single comet tail, but there's actually many different types of comet tails. Some of them come out the sunward side. And a week ago, I talked about the horns of the bull at Io at Jupiter and the horns of the bull that the ancients saw with the comet Venus. There's the sunward discharge spike, which is the visible, when the electron beam comes out from the sun, it pulls itself together. It's called the pinch effect. And so when any charged stream is moving, it creates a self-induced magnetic field, and it pulls itself together into a tight bundle. Very interesting property of moving charged particles. But since there is this electron beam coming out from the sun, it pinches, it pulls itself together, and so when it hits the comet nucleus, it's a very defined bundle. It's not a big, wide plasma. And so at any rate, when that electron beam starts to hit material in the comet region, gases, etc., that are around the comet nucleus coming in, being drawn into the comet nucleus, they start to interact and create X-rays. And so that is the source of X-rays in comets, and that's why they discovered the clouds of X-rays, or the signature of X-rays, out about 30,000 miles to the sunward side of comets. Isn't that interesting? So it's not charge exchange, Tom Cravens and Carrie Liss and boys. It's not charge exchange. In charge exchange, the process they talk about requires an electron beam to get it initiated. So where does their electron beam come from? Well, of course, they don't ever have to talk about that, because in the world of peer review publication, nobody can get in a word edgewise to criticize the so-called peer review publications. Comets also have redshifts, proven in 1986 with Halley's Comet. A group of astronomers went to South America with very good spectroscopy equipment and measured a redshift in Halley's Comet. And they threw the data away. They didn't publish it. Why? Because it doesn't fit in with the dirty snowball comet model. So let me relate this in the last few seconds to the ancients. Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, the Incas had them, the phoenix from South America, the Japanese dragon, all of these symbolisms of the comet Venus. I am out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. Remember that my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.